Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a longtime Arizona travel writer takes us up to the far northern edge of Arizona as summer winds down.
And we kick off a new series about the Valley's resort industry with a look back at its history.
But first, the Arizona Supreme Court is considering whether voters should be allowed to decide a proposal that would impact whether some judges would continue to face voters. A decision is expected soon. Two justices, Clint Bowlick and Catherine King, have recused themselves from the case since one of the provisions of the ballot measure would retroactively return them to the bench even if voters decide not to retain them in November. But as Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services reports, those are the only two justices who decided not to take part. He joins me now to talk more about this. And Howie, you wrote about something Chief Justice Ann Scott Timber told you, which is that there's really no hard and fast rule about when a justice needs to stand down from a case.
Exactly. And this is the same thing, obviously, we've seen at the U.S. Supreme Court over things like whether Justice Thomas should step down in cases where he knows somebody or maybe he's even taken money from someone. This is all left to the individual justices. And there is no way for the other justices, whether here or in Washington, to say, you know, you really ought to step down or we're going to make you step aside. This is left to the individual justices and their own decisions. So, for example, in this case, where you're going to be deciding a proposition that has to do with whether judges get de facto lifetime appointments, Justices Clint Bowlick and Catherine King did recuse themselves because they're the ones who would most immediately be affected. That has to do with the quirk in the way the proposition is worded. It not only says that you don't have to stand or retain, reject using the current merit system if, in fact, you haven't run into a problem like having a felony, but it also says that if voters pass this proposition, it won't matter if the voters were to turn Clint Bowlick and Catherine King out of office because the measure is set up to be retroactive. So they're the ones who are most affected. They made the decision without explanation to recuse themselves. Now, is everyone else on the court going to be affected at some point? Yes, in fact, if voters pass this, the justices who would normally get six-year terms will not have to face voters again. But as Justice Timmer said, this is something that's a lot of ifs involved. And it's really not immediate, it's sort of attenuated. And well, speaking obviously only for herself, she said she didn't see any sort of conflict that would require her to recuse herself. Now, the other justices chose not to speak with me about it, and certainly that is their right, and you know, can't force that. But what makes it interesting, of course, is if they had all recused themselves, you would have been in a situation, well, who do you find to judge this? You'd have to find some justices, perhaps who are already retired, who would not be affected by this. And that gets into a whole nother situation where you have an acting Supreme Court, if you will.
Well, so what did Justice Timmer say about how she was thinking about this particular case? Like, why was it maybe so speculative to her whether or not she would be impacted by it?
I think the issue comes down to a couple of things. Number one, she is not up for retain reject until 2028. And her thought was she may not even seek another term, another six-year term. So you have that. But even if she were, I think the idea is it's not immediate. Now, again, this is all in the eyes of the beholder. You know, every justice has to decide where they can set themselves and their views apart. One of the points she made was, look, that she's already vested in her retirement. If somehow she were to either keep her job or lose her job, none of that matters. This compares, for example, to several years ago, where you had a case before the Arizona Supreme Court about changes to the judge's pension system. And she and the other justices all recused themselves for the simple reason that we're not just talking about some speculative thing that may happen in the future. Depending on who would win, the justices could stand to get a lot of money immediately and then not have to pay as much money into the pension plan in the future. And I think from her perspective is That clearly was the kind of thing, while we don't like to believe we can just judge things on the academic basis, when there's real money involved, she said it was better to step away. And again, there's no requirement. There's nothing in the law, nothing in the Arizona Constitution that says when this has to happen.
So, Howie, you've been covering the state Supreme Court and legal cases for many years. I'm curious what you hear from judges and justices about the optics of it looking like there could be a conflict or reason to recuse versus the actual reason, you know, there being an actual reason for a judge or a justice to recuse themselves in a case.
Well, I think each one, again, decides for himself or herself. For example, we had this come up with Bill Montgomery in an abortion case where originally he declined to recuse himself, despite the fact he had said specific things about Planned Parenthood, which was a party to the case, and then came back and said, well, yeah, based on some new information, which he never disclosed, he said, I think that it just does not seem to be right. I think each of them relies on their own internal compass. I mean, we all do that. I mean, look, as a reporter, I have feelings on a lot of things that I cover. I try to stay out of the things that will affect me financially, but let's say my stock portfolio, let's assume I've got 200 shares of Kroger Markets, and there's a whole merger thing between Kroger and Albertsons. Can I write fairly about that based on the fact that I have 200 shares of Kroger? I'd like to believe I can, because I'd say that any decision that's made, whether it there is or is not a merger, and clearly I don't have the power of a justice to decide whether it will be so minimally affected, attenuated, I think is a term that Justice Timmer used, that there could be no argument that somehow my reporting is being affected. And I think the justices each look at it that way. The question of whether their decisions would be affected based on something that may happen in the future, which might not happen. And as, again, the point is that what the justices are deciding, not whether the proposition is a good or bad idea, but simply a question of should it not go to the voters.
Right. All right. We'll have to leave it there. That is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks as always. I appreciate it.
Have a great morning.
Ray Delahanty spent most of his career working in urban planning, but today he's best known as City Nerd. His YouTube channel with nearly 300,000 subscribers and 30 million views. It's all about cities and transportation, and you guessed it, he has come to Phoenix.
It's fair to ask, why did I willingly submit myself to spending 3 days in Phoenix at the end of the hottest June on record? Maybe I have a screw loose, but I really did want to experience the reality of the way things actually are for a significant portion of the year in the hottest major city in the US. Plus, if I'm not willing to suffer for my content, then how can I really expect you to watch it?
He came here at this time of year at the request of the Urban Phoenix Project, an urbanist organization that's all for walking, biking, and urban transit. They did an event at the Royale in the Melrose neighborhood while he was here, as he traveled the city via light rail, Waymo, and yes, by foot. He's not a fan of the controversial reverse suicide lanes on 7th Street and 7th Avenue, but he thinks the city is doing some things right, especially in new developments along the light rail and in downtown Phoenix. And now he's made one of his videos outlining his impressions of Phoenix's urban transit, the good, the bad, and the mildly dystopian, as he puts it. Here's our conversation.
When I go to cities, I like to kind of try to tease out the things that are unique about them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one thing you could say is unique or exceptional about Phoenix is how hot it gets for, I mean, definitely the peak of summer, but a lot of months of the year. And that really informs the way people live and the way they get around the city. And so when I go and shoot video on location in cities, I mostly spend my time walking because that's really just kind of the best way to experience things. Sometimes I'll bike and I'll take transit or whatever, but I try not to rely on cars too much. But I spent quite a bit of time walking out in like 108 degree heat shooting film of, you know, things like 7th Street and 7th Avenue. So that wasn't super pleasant, but it was really interesting for sure.
Yeah. So, okay. So you come to Phoenix in probably the hottest time of year, the worst time of year. There's not as many people, I'm sure, on the street at this moment. But what you're looking at, right, is the way in which the city is structured for pedestrians, for bikers, in terms of public transit. I want to talk about the good and the bad and your impressions, right? But let's start with the good, because Phoenix gets a really bad rap in this arena, as I'm sure you're aware. So you talked about the light rail. You talked about some of the newer developments. What is Phoenix doing well, from your point of view?
Yeah, I mean, I spent quite a bit of time in the downtown area. And, you know, one thing I do like is, and I'm kind of a sports fan, so I love a downtown stadium or a downtown arena. I'm a huge NBA basketball fan. I'm not really a Phoenix Suns fan.
Fair.
I grew up in Seattle and lived in Portland for a while. The Suns have always been kind of a rival. But I love an arena and a baseball stadium that are really well connected to transit and that are in close proximity to all the amenities that you have in a downtown area. And, you know, I spent some time up on Roosevelt Row, which, you know, in the middle of the day in late June is not particularly bustling with people out, you know, walking from place to place. But I made a point of going back there after dark. I think I went back at like 9 p.m. or something, when people actually start coming out and spending time outside, even
We're
though it's still
here,
like, yeah, I know, it's still probably like 98 degrees or something like that. But you know, it's relatively livable at that point. Mm-hmm. So I kind of enjoyed seeing just kind of the way people live and the way people adapt and respond to what are pretty inhospitable conditions. So I kind of enjoyed that area and was sort of inspired by the way the city is kind of leveraging the infrastructure there and the old urban street fabric and the grid that's already in place.
Yeah. Okay, so some good things, but let's talk about the bad, because there were certainly some parts of Phoenix that you were not as impressed with. Let's talk about the Sevens, right? 7th Avenue and 7th Street. Tell us about your impressions there.
Yeah, I mean, so that was something I really wanted to make a point of, you know, spending some time filming and thinking about, because it is, I wouldn't say it's completely unique. There are a couple other cities that have reverse lanes. I think Santa Clara up in the Bay Area still has a reverse lane roadway, but it's something that you used to see more of. And those still exist in Phoenix. I wanted to see the way they were laid out and the way drivers used them and how hospitable they were for people walking or taking transit. And it's tough out there. Everything about it is really engineered to try to provide as much capacity for drivers as possible.
Right.
But to the detriment of any other person who could possibly be using the street. So like me out there walking like an idiot on a 108 degree day, right? With very few exceptions, you know, it's just what we call a curb tight sidewalk. So there's no planted strip between the sidewalk and the roadway. So you've got cars zooming by you, usually at like 45 or maybe more miles per hour. And so it's noisy and kind of dirty and uncomfortable.
I mean, those reverse lanes are super controversial here, but you call them, and I'd never heard this term before, so I have to ask you about it, strodes, right? Well, what does that mean, a strode?
Oh, yeah. You know, that's going to be a new term to a lot of people. So strode, it's kind of like a mashup or a portmanteau of street and road, where the idea is that a street is a roadway that is kind of built to provide access to commercial destinations. So you think about like a main street, right, with storefronts along it. And then the road part is more like a highway. It's really there to provide limited access and high speeds and efficiency as far as traffic goes. And so a strode is a roadway that is really trying to accomplish both of those things at the same time and just not really succeeding at either. And I've heard it referred to as kind of like the futon of of transportation infrastructure, where it's kind of a couch and it's kind of a bed, but it doesn't really work well as either.
So, I mean, basically the criticism there, right, is that it's so car-centric, right, which is kind of the way the city was built, or at least has been built up until maybe the last 5 or 10 years. Is that a bad thing? Like, is there a way to balance both of those things? You know, have a road where people can drive back and forth quickly in the middle of the city, but also have it be pedestrian friendly?
I think it's really tough. It's possible. I mean, you can find highways that have like separated multi-use paths on them where there's some kind of physical barrier between the highway and the sidewalk. But you usually won't find something that in an urban environment because the access to commercial properties on either side of the street is so important. And that's something you observe on 7th Avenue, for example, through the Melrose District. There are tons of, you know, commercial destinations along there. But then at these peak times of day, where the central lane on 7th Avenue is functioning as kind of a through traffic lane, and left turns are either, you know, prohibited or limited to a couple locations, you know, that's tough for those businesses.
I want to ask you about Waymos, because I know you did a little experimental riding in some Waymos that are all over Phoenix roads today. They're not in a lot of other cities. What did you make of this and its possibilities for the future of urban transportation?
Yeah, coming to Phoenix and realize that they had been so widely adopted and they had such a large service area.
Yeah.
And so a couple of people told me, hey, that's part of the experience. You have to try it when you come out. And I was like, oh, I'm kind of nervous about that. But as I walked around, I saw a few of them in operation and I thought, oh, that looks reasonable. I would try that. And plus, you know, I have a YouTube channel. How can I not make content about that? So it was kind of a must. And so I ended up riding the Waymos four different times, I think, that came in handy because, you know, transit wasn't going to get me where I wanted to go. And the impression that was most striking to me was that they adhere to traffic laws in a way that human drivers just don't, right? So I kind of came away thinking, you know, even a strode or a very car-oriented street could be a lot safer and more humane if there were nothing but Waymos on them, which is not the impression I expected to come away with.
Yeah.
But that's what I felt after a couple days of both walking around Phoenix and then riding the Waymo.
Yeah. That is Ray Delahanty, City Nerd on YouTube. Ray, thank you so much for coming on. This was fascinating to see Phoenix from your perspective.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And about those reverse traffic lanes, there is an effort to end them in the Valley, but the city has cited a study it commissioned in 2021 that found traffic would increase more than 40% without them.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we are traveling to the far northern edge of the state, to the Arizona Strip.
It's deserted, and they've got an incredible trail there called the River Trail. It's just 1 mile long, and it's perfectly level. And just like it promises, it just follows the Colorado River and these cliffs, and it is so gorgeous.
A longtime Arizona travel writer shares his tips.
But first, travel and tourism have been big industries in the Phoenix area for decades. Winter-weary East Coasters and Midwesterners are just those looking for something different, headed west in search of adventure or maybe just some sunshine. A group called the Arizona Development Board estimated tourism accounted for $160 million to the state in 1954. That's nearly $2 billion in today's dollars. More recently, the Arizona Office of Tourism reports the travel industry brought more than $28 billion in direct spending to the state. And a lot of those visitors to the Valley over the years have stayed in resorts. A number of those early spots have since been closed and torn down, but not all of them. Many still in operation have been hosting travelers for many years, while others have been open for many fewer years. Today, we're kicking off a new series here on the show looking at the history and future of resorts and the Valley as a resort community. We're calling it Last Resorts. Over the next several weeks, we'll travel from Paradise Valley to Litchfield Park and visit some of the Valley's oldest and newest resorts and hear how they've impacted the region from art and architecture to how people all over the world view the West.
From all over the world come visitors to relax and rest in the sun-drenched desert of Arizona. Dude ranches, great resort hotels, inns.
Scottsdale is delightful and clean and new.
Phoenix, a simply splendid city. Don't worry for a minute about a place to stay.
There is a ruggedness here, a loveliness here, that combines into a package of colorful memories. History, wildlife, entertainment, grandeur, they're all here awaiting you on your Arizona holiday.
And we start our series with a look back to some of the earliest resorts, both here in the Valley and across Arizona. To help do that, I'm joined by Claire McWilliams, an assistant teaching professor at ASU, where she teaches classes on tourism development and management. And Claire, the state has had tourism as a big part of its economy for a long time. Resorts and hotels, of course, have been a big part of that. From your perspective, where did all that start?
I think the story is the same as it would be in modern day, which is, you know, Arizona has its five C's: cattle, citrus, copper, and cotton. But then there's climate. That's a C. We have been a winter escape climate for a long, long time. And then our other C is the canyon. We have a celebrated natural wonder in the state, and people have been wanting to see it for a long, long time. And that's, in my opinion, kind of the birth of part of our industry is at the canyon, with the Grand Canyon Hotel being built in 1892. And I want to say that lodging kind of always mirrors whatever the attractions that are being developed are and what the transportation innovations are of the day.
So at the Grand Canyon, for example, that would be natural wonders and railroads, right?
Absolutely. So if you think about, let's say, the late 1800s, there were these magazines being published like Scribner's and National Geographic, and they painted this beautiful picture of the canyon, maybe the Southwest at large, if you will. And that captured the imaginations of people who, for the first time, had time and money to participate in leisure away from home. And yes, railways come along. They make Arizona accessible. And you have early hoteliers and entrepreneurs like Fred Harvey. I don't know if you've heard of his Harvey Girls, but he set up shop in the 1880s along the Santa Fe Railway route and started employing females as providing great service in his hotels and restaurants along the way.
So at what point and how did all of this migrate south? Because the Phoenix area has also for a very long time, probably not as long as the Grand Canyon, but for a very long time, been a community that is really that for which tourism is very important and has had a lot of hotels and resorts.
Well, kind of moving south with the creation of the national park system and the fact that we have so many national parks in our state, again, coupling that with the weather, I think it made perfect sense that tourism would start to move into the valley, people wanting to explore during those winter escape months and finding their way to other attractions in doing so. I think the fact that we have another C, which is culture, and we have this access here in the valley, our proximity to Mexico, our 22 federally recognized Native American tribes in the state, there's just a fertile place in all areas of the state for tourism to grow. And it certainly did here in the valley. I think of some really cool hotels historically, like the Hotel San Carlos, which opened up in 1928. I actually see it out the window of my downtown campus at ASU. The Wigwam out in Litchfield Park, or the Arizona Biltmore, which were both opened in 1929. And then maybe another reason for the valley gaining a lot of resort-style lodging is golf.
Yeah. When did a lot of these places start popping up? You mentioned, for example, the Wigwam and the Biltmore in the late 20s and the San Carlos, but, you know, there are were a ton of resorts that came after that. Was there sort of a heyday for them?
I think in every decade, you can find some interesting types of resorts that became part of the narrative of Arizona. And some I can think of would be like in the 1930s. That's when Camelback Inn, which is now a JW Marriott, and then the beautiful Hermosa Inn that opened up in 1936. So that decade saw some really beautiful kind of iconic Arizona properties. And then, you know, you can go into the whole Route 66 component. That's the Motor Hotel, which is just a portmanteau. That's what motel is a motor hotel. And, you know, after World War II, people were road tripping all over the state.
At what point did resorts become a place to go, like in and of themselves, almost regardless of where they were, as opposed to like going to a resort in Phoenix and then sort of exploring around the area?
I think that's been in development for a long time, and maybe Arizona's early to figuring out that you don't have to just stay at a place and then go elsewhere for your fine dining, entertainment, etc., that you can do that where you are if you're in the right resort. So we don't have to look at modern day to see that. You can look back at the history of the Biltmore, other places, and see that those places were iconic attractions of their own. So I think it's not about when they started, it's just how they ramped up to the reputation that they have today.
So when you look at how resorts now market themselves and the kinds of amenities they offer, how much of it is about trying to keep people who are staying there at that property versus, you know, saying, hey, if you come to Phoenix, you can go, you know, see X, Y, and Z and do this and that. And then, you know, maybe come back for the spa and a round of golf and a nice meal in the evening.
Well, here's another great example is the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act of 1988. These are properties that there's a lot of hotel properties that are now attached to casinos. So there's a unique opportunity to make everything that you want or need in one space, starting with gaming and then moving your way out from there. You could look at places like where Talking Stick is, the Salt River Pima Maricopa reservation near Scottsdale. That's kind of a lodging corridor, an entertainment corridor, if you will, whether it's wanting to you know, do privately owned attractions or spring training. It's all in one spot. So I think that it's easier now for hotels to position themselves to be not only a lodging place, but one where you can catch a show and do a variety of entertaining things while you're there, not just to stay.
How important are resorts to Arizona's economy and Arizona's tourism economy in 2024?
Well, I think COVID showed us how important they are, because when it all shut down, it was rough. It was kind of a horrific toll short term on our industry with hotel closures and financial losses, and really, from my perspective, a loss of talent that we still feel today. So I think having things taken away is the first way of really seeing how important they are to our economy. 2019, the year before we had COVID, was a record-breaking year in Arizona, $25 billion in direct spending. That's
wow.
A figure from the Arizona Office of Tourism. So it is really important. And I would like to say to you that just like tourism disappearing overnight is a nightmare, I also think that unmanaged tourism growth can also be a nightmare. So I think all of our resort community, our lodging, and all the other sectors of tourism really need to work on finding balance and finding out what our carrying capacity is to make sure that we have the right types of tourism and the right types of projects developed versus just unchecked tourism growth, which can lead to places that I don't know if the Valley would really like to go in.
I'm curious what the future for resorts in the Valley looks like to you. I mean, we just had, for example, Caesars opening its facility in Scottsdale. The first, you mentioned casinos, the first one that didn't have a casino under the Caesars brand.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to go there with my students and take a tour of it when it opened. And it's an amazing property. What it looks like on the inside compared to what you see on the outside, you don't expect what you see when you walk in there. So yeah, I think a variety of models are waiting. There's a lot of projects that are waiting to happen, that are getting ready to open. So I don't see any stop to it in the near future in terms of projects. Also interested in the partnerships that are out there, the kind of like sports tourism, for example, lots of interesting partnerships happening there.
Claire McWilliams is an assistant teaching professor at ASU, where she teaches classes on tourism development and management. Next week, as part of our Last Resort series, we'll check out a collection of historic postcards depicting a part of Phoenix that set the stage for the region becoming a resort community.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody, and we're joined now in studio by the show's Sam Dingman. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning, folks. So for today's show, I spoke to Kelly McDonough, a professor at UT Austin, who has just published a book called Indigenous Science and Technology. McDonough's research centers on the Nahua community in Mexico. And among other things, she writes about Nahua people who consider themselves scientists, not because they work in a laboratory, but because they use science every day, whether they're farming, weaving, or writing poetry. But McDonough's goal with this book extends well beyond profiles of the Nahua community. She writes, quote, "In choosing the term science, I am not attempting to elevate indigenous sciences in order to be equal to Western science. It is instead to insist that Western science, technology, and knowledge are only one of many sciences, technologies, and knowledges rather than the pinnacle. McDonough envisions a world where we move away from a single dominant perspective on science and towards what she calls an ecology of knowledges.
I think when we allow for different ways of knowing, different ways of thinking, and we actually celebrate that and put that into operation, I think we can all have better lives. I don't want to instrumentalize only non-Western science. Like what happens a lot is, and we're seeing this a lot in the news lately, oh, in California, they're realizing that indigenous peoples did control burns before, and that's what helped them survive. I don't want to necessarily think about indigenous science as something that can be extracted and utilized, because that's sort of the experience that has been going on and on, this extraction and utilization.
Yeah.
But, you know, we always talk about thinking outside the box, right? And when we bring all of these different ways of knowing, different knowledges together, I think we have a better chance of surviving.
The word that kept coming to mind for me as I was going through the book is fluency, and this sense that somebody who's a weaver or a poet, they have to have a fluency with natural phenomena in order to do their work. And that level of awareness, sensitivity to the rhythms and processes of the natural world is not something that we tend to find outside of a laboratory in kind of mainstream academic scientific culture. Mm-hmm. And it struck me that that would be another benefit of this ecology of knowledges that you're talking about, is this sense that by having an embodied understanding of science, we would appreciate it a little bit differently and think of it less as a kind of sterile laboratory process, sort of like a secret code that only some people have access to.
Right. One of the things I talk about is there are a couple of ways that people gain this fluency that you're talking about. And one is ancestral knowledge that's just passed on and on and on, and that is communicated in the household on a regular basis. So there's learning in the field. There's learning at the fireside. And they're not discounting what's in books, and they're not discounting what is happening in what we call Western laboratories at all. But what they have is this knowledge based on experience coupled with that ancestral knowledge that has been passed on.
Speaking of the passing on of knowledge, a lot of the book is also focused on this kind of remarkable document called the Florentine Codex, or Florentine Codex.
Yes.
Tell us about the Florentine Codex.
It's actually an unfinished work. It's a 16th century, I would maybe describe today as sort of an encyclopedia, a 12-book encyclopedia. It was the brainchild of a Franciscan friar, Bernardino de Sahagún, and Nahua scholars that he was working with. And in fact, we have documentation that some of these Nahua scholars were actually students of his, and that's how he really brought them into this project. Sahagún and these Nahua scholars would, in a couple of different places, right in what we know today as Mexico City, would talk to elders and talk to bean sellers and talk to folks that worked as fishermen. Some books have to do with their descriptions of the gods. Others are descriptions of advice that elders would give. And Sahagún was a Franciscan friar, so he had this idea that if you are going to root out heresy or idolatry, you need to know what it looks like. And so he really wanted to get in there and document what do these people believe? How do they ceremoniously connect with what they believe? He saw a people, and in his mind, they were in decline. Of course, they were physically in decline because they were living through a series of pandemics.
Right.
And there are some different places in the Florentine Codex where I feel like the many, many Nahua people that had a hand in this weren't necessarily thinking about helping Sahagún root out heresy or helping the next priest that comes along learn their language. This was an opportunity, and you might think of it as salvage documentation. The priests previously had burned all of their books because they were supposedly, you know, carrying the word of the devil.
Right.
So a lot of these things that had been burned, this was their chance to put it back in writing. And it was a chance to make sure that those memories didn't die.
Yeah. I have this image as you're describing it, that it's almost like the codex itself is almost like a documentary, or, you know, maybe to use a more academic term, an ethnography, where instead of publishing this highly edited, curated version of this study of some group, you just kind of like released the transcripts.
Right, exactly. So some have called Sagoon a proto-ethnographer, or one of the early anthropologists. I mean, he certainly wasn't doing what we consider ethnography or anthropology today, but there was that sort of, let's get it all down.
Yeah. Well, so one of the things that is interesting about your incorporation of this document is that it seems to represent, as we've been discussing, a flawed but earnest attempt on the part of a non-Indigenous community to, in some ways, integrate Indigenous ideas into their understanding of the world. And it made me wonder, have there been any other attempts on the scale of the Florentine Codex in the ensuing centuries to undertake a similar effort?
Well, I mean, I definitely think that the Florentine Codex is unique. Mm-hmm. There's really nothing like it in the world.
I actually sort of wondered if your book was almost implicitly calling out the scientific community for not making a similarly holistic attempt in the ensuing 500 some years.
Well, I think, you know, lots of scholars have been doing that, you know, for, I want to say 50 years now. Mm-hmm. What I'm doing isn't new. It's just that doesn't tend to, what my grandma would say, it doesn't take, right? It doesn't stick. So if somebody that reads this book that grew up having only one science and it being Western or dominant culture science and starts to think a little differently about what science means, that's great. But what I'm really trying to do, I'm really trying to make sure that young Nahua people know what their science was, what it is, and what it can be.
Yeah. Well, Professor Kelly McDonough at the University of Texas at Austin, author of Indigenous Science and Technology. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. And now it's time for us to hit the road and head out into the wilder parts of our state with longtime Arizona travel writer Roger Naylor. And today we're venturing to the far northern edge of Arizona, where it is not exactly cool this time of year, but it's certainly a place you can go explore in the summer when it's 115 down here.
It's certainly much cooler than it is in the valley. And also, never forget that you'll have warm afternoons, but it will cool off dramatically in the evening. So you get the nice cool evenings, cool mornings and stuff. Maybe not as chilly as when you're at Flagstaff or Greer or someplace like that. But you're down on the water. You're in canyons. You're in shade. You're having all kinds of great fun.
Yeah, it sounds beautiful. Okay, so let's start in this region, the Arizona Strip. I've never heard of this. I've lived here most of my life.
Oh, my goodness.
What does this describe?
Well, the Arizona Strip is essentially the part of Arizona that's cut off from the rest of the state by the Colorado River.
Makes sense.
Which
okay.
is mostly the Grand Canyon. So it's that little section over there that is pretty inaccessible. The actual Strip is as large as Massachusetts with a population of 8,000. So, I mean, solitude is a very big thing here. It's really quite the middle of nowhere. And so you can explore deep into the Strip if you want. One of the things I like to do is kind of combine the eastern edge of the Arizona Strip and around the Navajo Bridge area along with Page, Lake Powell, and the Navajo Nation. So you're all right up along the edge of Utah there, and you're just experiencing some incredible sights on the Colorado Plateau.
Yeah. Okay. So what are some of your favorite places to explore up there? What do you find?
Well, one of the places I really like to get to right away is Lee's Ferry, which a lot of people have heard about. It's sort of a famous crossroads of history, but not a lot of people actually visit unless you're taking a rafting trip through the Grand Canyon because that's the put-in place. So you go there, and it's sort of in the middle of nowhere, but there's a whole bunch of people down on the ramp loading up their boats and slathering on the sunscreen and getting ready for their little adventure. But otherwise, it's deserted. And they've got an incredible trail there called the River Trail. It's just 1 mile long, and it's perfectly level. And just like it promises, it just follows the Colorado River and these cliffs. And it is so gorgeous. It takes you by some historic buildings. There's an old Mormon fort there that was never attacked, an old post office that never sent a letter. this is because this was such an outpost, such a remote area. A couple of people tried to get rich there, but with prospecting, nothing ever really panned out. So there's a boiler of an old steamboat that's still in the river there that you can see and stuff. But it's just so incredible. It's so peaceful. The water's flowing by, and you're walking beneath these colorful cliffs, and it's just really spectacular. Just about a mile away from there, behind that is the Lonely Dell Ranch, which is where John D. Lee and his family and all the other people who operated the ferry after that, that's where they lived. And again, since this is middle of nowhere, they had to be self-sufficient. So they had a big farm. There's these great orchards there that are still growing, and you can walk back there and pick a peach off the tree and eat it. It's all loud, and it's just the Paria River comes flowing by there. You can wander up to the river and stuff. I've had some great summer days back there. So that's an area that I really, really love that I just think a lot of people kind of overlook because, again, if you're not doing a river trip, then that's not a place you go to.
It sounds beautiful.
It is.
So tell us about some of the places you can get on the water. Where are your favorite kind of kayaking spots, especially for people who are not going to go all the way through the Grand Canyon, right?
Right. Well, and I'm not, I'm one of those people because I'm always a little nervous about water, but the best kayaking trip I've ever had in my life. You go to Cliff Dwellers Lodge, which is about 10 miles west of Navajo Bridge, and they rent and shuttle kayaks. So you can get a nice kayak there, and you tell them how long you want to go out. If you want to kayak for 2 hours, they'll drive you up the river, drop you off for that length. You can go all the way to Glen Canyon Dam. You can do it as an overnight trip and camp along the river if you want. But I think we went out like 6 hours. They dropped us off up the river, and we just floated, drifted down. It's all flat water because you're not in the Grand Canyon yet, so there's no rapids. It's just lazy summer days with 1,000-foot cliffs soaring above you, and it's just gorgeous. You're just drifting by. You actually go floating through Horseshoe Bend, that famous curve in the river.
What?
You glance up, and you see these little tiny people way up high above you. You kayak through Horseshoe Bend and down, and then you get out at Lee's Ferry, and that's where you get the kayaks back there.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not all water, though. You also get to tour, you talked about some pretty interesting cliff dwellings that I've never heard of up in this very far northern edge part of the state.
Yeah, over on the Navajo Nation is Navajo National Monument. Mm-hmm. They've got three cliff dwellings that they protect. Inscription House has been closed since 1968. Keats Seal is a fantastic cliff dwelling, but it can only be done as a guided overnight hike. But Batatican, which is one that I visited just last month, they do most weekends up until Labor Day, depending on staff shortage. They've been having some staffing issues, but usually there's a ranger. It has to be a guided hike, and you'll go out Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. You just need to check with the Navajo National Monument, give them a call, make sure you don't have to do a reservation, doesn't cost anything. But it is a 3 mile or 5 mile, depending on which route they take. But generally, it's a 5 mile round trip hike going down into the canyon. So there is some climbing in and out. But when I went, there was a mom with a couple of kids, and they seemed to be doing fine. And it's a gorgeous canyon. I would do the hike just even if there wasn't a cliff dwelling at the end of it, because it is a spectacular canyon. But you go down through there into this deep canyon, and there's this huge cliff dwelling that was built by the ancestors of the Hopi back about 1250 and was occupied up until about 1300.
Wow.
Used to be 125 rooms. Now there's about 80 still in this huge alcove because there's some rock falls that have destroyed some of them. But I mean, you know, they still have windows and ceilings and the original timbers intact, you know, from all these centuries.
So one of the things I think lots of people will think about, you think about Horseshoe Bend if you're up in this part of the state, you think about the wave, right? Like that famous hike that is impossible to get a permit to do, right? Everyone wants to go take a picture there. Right. But you're saying there's another one that's almost as good?
Well, I don't want to say almost as good, but it is being called the New Wave Trail. It's actually, its official name is the Beehive Trail, and it's right there in Page. It's just about a half mile past the Carl Hayden Visitor Center at the dam and directly across from the Beehive campsites there. It's a 1.5 mile round trip hike, but it takes you across the same formations. It's slick rock hiking. It's canyon country hiking. Slick rock refers to any expanse of sandstone that's level enough to walk or ride on. And I always love slick rock hiking. It's just, it's like you're walking on the bones of the land. It's just you feel that hardness and that surface and you're tilted and the way it rolls. It's just beautiful. The wind has left its fingerprints all over this with those swirls and curves and swoops. And it's just really elegant. It's very beautiful. You make a nice little loop through there and it's free. It's you know, it's a great little surprise that a lot of people don't know about, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Longtime Arizona travel writer Roger Naylor. His forthcoming book is called Arizona National Parks and Monuments. Roger, thanks as always for coming in. I appreciate it very much.
Always a delight. Great to see you.
And that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. Remember, follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ, the show. Maybe Lauren will post some pictures from her hikes.
I gotta go.
From the Arizona Strip.
I'd never heard of that. I think the Lee's Ferry one sounds amazing. I want to try
The whole
that.
Place sounds pretty cool.
Pretty amazing.
Pretty
yeah.
cool.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.